The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today we're wrestling with something pretty fundamental, maybe the most fundamental thing, consciousness itself.
That's right. We're diving into Susan Blackmore's work.
Yes.
Specifically, her really challenging idea that our sense of a conscious self, you know, me inside,
yeah.
and the feeling that we perceive this rich, detailed reality all around us.
Yeah.
And well, her argument is that it's basically a grand illusion, something constructed by the brain.
A grand illusion. That's a big claim. It feels so real, though, this continuous inner movie.
It absolutely does. And that's the paradox, isn't it?
Yeah.
We all have this powerful intuition of being a unified self experiencing the world directly.
Right. Like a little person inside watching the screen.
Exactly. But Blackmore says, based on a lot of science, that little person, that central controller,
yeah,
it just doesn't exist in the way we think.
Yeah. So our mission today is to unpack that, to really look at why she says our common sense understanding might be completely wrong.
And maybe, just maybe, understand why the hard problem of consciousness, you know, why we have subjective experience at all, might stem from asking the wrong question in the first place.
Because we're assuming something exists, this unified self, that might not.
Precisely. If the premise is flawed, maybe the problem itself kind of dissolves.
Okay, let's get into it. But first, tell us a bit about Susan Blackmore herself. Her background seems, well, pretty unique for tackling this.
Oh, absolutely. She has a PhD in psychology. She's taught for decades. But what makes her perspective so compelling is her journey.
Right. She wasn't always a skeptic, was she? Didn't she start out investigating things like ESP parapsychology?
She did. That's what's fascinating. She spent years seriously investigating paranormal phenomena. But crucially, she followed the evidence or lack thereof.
And concluded there wasn't reliable proof.
Exactly. Which shows, I think, a real intellectual honesty. She was willing to abandon her initial interests when the data didn't support them.
That's a rare quality.
It is. And then there's her work on memes, you know, from her book, The Meme Machine.
Ah, right. The idea of ideas as replicators. How does that connect?
Well, it gives her a framework for thinking about the self, not as a biological thing, but as a powerful idea, a meme complex that constructs our sense of identity. It replicates because it's useful.
A useful story we tell ourselves.
Kind of. And then there's the third layer. Mm-hmm. She's a long-term Zen meditation practitioner.
So she combines the objective third-person science with serious, disciplined first-person introspection.
Precisely. It's that combination rigorous science plus deep personal experience that gives her such a unique vantage point for deconstructing consciousness.
Okay, so bringing that all together, what's the central argument in her work on consciousness? You said it's not something we have.
Right. It's not a thing, like a brain module or some kind of substance. For Blackmore, consciousness is something we do.
Something we do? Like an activity?
Yeah, think of it as a collection of ongoing processes. Attention, memory retrieval, sensory processing, narrative generation, all happening in parallel.
And we mistakenly bundle all that activity up and label it me experiencing things from a central point.
That's the core idea. The book systematically tries to dismantle the pillars supporting that mistaken view.
What are the pillars?
Well, first, the idea that our visual experience is rich and continuous like a movie. Second, the feeling of a single unified self in charge. And third, the sense that we have conscious free will directing our actions.
Okay, let's take those one by one. The perception one, that our inner world is like a high-definition video feed. This is where it gets really interesting with the experiments, right?
Definitely. This is where the science directly contradicts our feeling. We feel like we see everything clearly and continuously.
But we don't.
Not even close. Think about change blindness experiments.
Yeah, where huge things in a picture can change. And if there's a flicker or distraction, you just don't see the change at all.
Exactly. Or inattentional blindness, the famous gorilla experiment. People are so focused on counting basketball passes, they completely miss someone in a gorilla suit walking through the scene.
Which proves what exactly?
It proves we're only consciously processing a tiny fraction of the information hitting our senses at any moment. Our eyes are constantly darting around saccades, and we're technically blind during those movements.
So the brain is just filling in the gaps, creating a good enough model.
Pretty much. It grabs details when needed, on the fly, and constructs this illusion of a stable, detailed world. It's incredibly efficient for survival, but it's not an accurate recording.
It feels accurate, though.
That feeling is the illusion. The brain generates the feeling of richness, but the underlying data is sparse and constantly being updated, guessed at.
Wow. Okay, so our reality stream isn't what we think it is. Now, what about the I that's supposedly watching this potentially fake stream? The self.
Ah, yes, the self. This is maybe the biggest target of the book. Blackmore argues the self isn't a solid entity at all.
Not a thing.
Not a thing. It's more like a narrative. She borrows Daniel Gennett's term, a center of narrative gravity.
Center of narrative gravity. Explain that. Like the center of gravity in physics. It's not a real part, just a useful calculation point.
Exactly. It's a useful fiction, a story the brain constantly spins to make sense of its actions and experiences, to interact socially. But there's no actual thing at the center corresponding to that eye.
And the evidence for that comes from split-brain patients.
That's some of the most compelling evidence, yes. These are patients where the connection between the two brain hemispheres, the corpus callosum, is cut, often to treat severe epilepsy.
And what happens?
Well, you can present information to just one hemisphere. So you show the right hemisphere, which usually controls the left hand and isn't typically verbal, and instruction, like walk. Mm. The person might get up and start walking.
Okay.
Then you ask the left hemisphere, the one that speaks and generates the eye narrative, why are you walking?
And what does it say? Does it say, I don't know?
Rarely. The left hemisphere, which didn't see the instruction and didn't initiate the walking, will instantly confabulate. It will make up a plausible reason.
Like what?
Like, oh, I decided I needed to get a soda. It creates a story, post hoc, to maintain the illusion that I am in charge and made a conscious decision.
Wait, so part of the brain is basically lying to another part, or rather lying to itself, to keep the story of a unified self going.
That's a good way to put it. The unity isn't built in. It's actively, constantly constructed and maintained, even when the underlying processes are clearly divided. It shows how fragile that feeling of unity really is.
Okay, my head is spinning slightly. If the self is a post hoc storyteller, what does that do to free will? This takes us to Libet, right?
Yes, the Benjamin Libet experiments. Absolutely crucial. They seem to strike at the heart of conscious agency.
Remind us how those worked.
So Libet had people make a simple voluntary action, like flexing their wrist whenever they felt the urge. They also had to note the exact moment they felt the conscious intention, the decision to act.
Okay, and he measured brain activity.
Right. He measured the readiness potential, a buildup of electrical activity in the brain that precedes voluntary movement. The bombshell finding was when this potential started.
When did it start?
It started significantly before the person reported having the conscious intention to move. Sometimes by hundreds of milliseconds.
Before. So the brain was already preparing the action before the person felt like they decided to act.
Yeah, that's what the data suggests. The conscious awareness of the decision seems to come after the brain has already initiated the process.
So the feeling of I decided to do that is more like a notification, an awareness that something is already underway rather than the actual command.
That's the interpretation Blackmore and others draw. The conscious experience of willing isn't the cause. It's part of the aftermath. We mistake the report for the command.
Like the brain's press secretary announcing a decision that was actually made elsewhere in the government.
Huh. That's a perfect analogy. The conscious EE takes credit, keeps the narrative smooth, but it wasn't the original decision maker.
But hang on. If we're not consciously willing our actions in the way we think, what does that mean for, well, for everything? Responsibility, morality. If I didn't really decide, who is responsible?
That's the really tough question, isn't it? And it's a valid concern. Blackmore's perspective generally isn't that we have no freedom or responsibility, but that we need to rethink what we mean by them. Maybe it's not about some non-physical will making a choice, but about the complex physical system, the person, the brain-body system, responding to reasons, laws, consequences.
So the system can still be held accountable, even if the conscious feeling of choice is a bit of a neurological trick.
That's one way to look at it. The focus shifts from blaming an illusory ghost in the machine to understanding the functioning decision-making organism as a whole. It doesn't necessarily upend law, but it changes the philosophical grounding.
Okay. There's a lot to chew on there. Let's try to pull out some core themes from all this. You mentioned consciousness as a process, not a thing.
Yeah, that's probably the most fundamental shift in perspective she advocates. Stop thinking of consciousness as something static you have, like a possession.
And start thinking of it as something dynamic the brain does.
Exactly. A collection of activities. This view, she argues, helps dissolve some of those thorny philosophical problems that arise when you treat it like a mysterious substance.
She has a quote about that, doesn't she?
She does. Consciousness is not something you have, it is something you do, and when you stop doing it, it ceases to exist. It emphasizes the active, ongoing nature of it.
And another key theme seems to be skepticism about our own inner feelings, the unreliability of introspection.
Absolutely central. We feel like we have direct, privileged access to our own minds, but the evidence suggests our internal reports are often flawed, biased, or just plain wrong, like the split brain confabulation.
So we should trust third-person scientific observation more than our first-person gut feelings.
That's the implication for a scientific understanding. Our introspection is often a post-hoc rationalization, not a pure window onto reality.
And this connects to her meditation practice too, right? The idea of looking for the observer.
Yes. She often points out that in practices like Zen, when you try to pinpoint the self or the observer experiencing thoughts, you just find more thoughts, more observing.
Every time you look for the observer, all you find is more observing.
Precisely. There's no stable entity back there pulling the strings, just the processes themselves.
Which leads to the final, maybe most challenging theme, the grand illusion itself.
Right. The culmination of all this is that the persistent feeling of being an I, a continuous self having experiences, that feeling itself is one of the products, one of the constructions of these unconscious brain processes.
The eye isn't the audience, it's part of the show.
That's a great way to put it. As Blackmore says, the sense that I am a persisting self who has experiences is one of the most persistent illusions created by the processes of consciousness itself.
Okay, deep breath. If we accept even some of this, what are the real life implications? How does understanding this illusion actually, you know, help us? Does it just make us question everything?
Well, it can be destabilizing at first, but Blackmore argues it can actually be incredibly beneficial, especially for mental well-being.
How so?
Think about how much suffering comes from rigidly defending our sense of self, our ego, our identity, our story about who I am.
Right. Getting offended, feeling like a failure, holding grudges.
Exactly. If you start to see that self as less of a fixed, precious thing and more of a fluid construction, a useful narrative that can be updated, it can bring a lot of relief.
You mean by not taking the story quite so seriously?
Sort of. Yeah. By holding our self-concept more lightly, recognizing it's a process, not a permanent statue. This is very much aligned with insights from mindfulness and contemplative traditions. Less attachment to the I often means less suffering.
That makes sense. If I failed becomes this process experienced a setback, it feels less total, less crushing.
Precisely. It allows for learning and adaptation without the ego getting shattered every time things don't go perfectly according to the narrative.
Okay, I can see the mental health angle. What about professionally? Or just in daily decision making? If our conscious mind confabulates, how do we use that knowledge?
I think the biggest takeaway there is intellectual humility. Meaning, we should be much more skeptical of our own gut feelings, our strong convictions, our sense of certainty, knowing that the feeling of knowing or deciding can be a post hoc fabrication.
Means we should probably double check. Seek outside data.
Exactly. Rely more on evidence, diverse perspectives, structured decision-making processes, rather than just assuming our internal conscious reasoning is automatically correct or in charge.
So don't just trust the press secretary's smooth explanation. Look at the raw data coming from the different departments.
That's the idea. Be aware of the brain's tendency to create a neat story and question it.
So wrapping up, what's the single biggest takeaway for you from Blackmore's challenging view?
For me, it really is that profound intellectual humility.
Yeah.
It forces a move away from picturing ourselves as these rational, unified commanders, the Cartesian theater idea, towards seeing ourselves as complex, decentralized systems constantly telling stories.
Yeah.
It's humbling, but also kind of liberating.
Yeah, I agree. And my takeaway is the transformative potential. It sounds radical, maybe even scary, but understanding consciousness as a process, an illusionary construction in some ways, doesn't have to be nihilistic.
Right.
It actually opens up ways to be maybe more conscious in a practical sense, more aware of our own biases, less attached to ego, potentially less prone to suffering caused by clinging to a fixed self. It feels useful.
It can be. It reframes self-improvement not as polishing a statue, but as skillfully guiding a dynamic process.
Which leaves us with a final thought to mull over. If the self is a narrative construction, a story the brain tells, who or what is writing the next sentence? Something to think about. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.